We cover many serious issues in this podcast. This discussion may contain reference to domestic violence, sexual violence, violence against children, suicide, drug use, or graphic depictions of death or dead bodies. It is not suitable for all audiences.
Tonight on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, two friends get together to discuss episodes of their favorite television show, Unsolved Mysteries. Will they find answers? Will anyone care? You may be able to solve a mystery.
Hello, you are listening to Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. My name is Forsyth, joined by my co-host, Mark. Mark, how are you?
I'm great, Kim. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. This is like kind of a special episode because we are talking about season two of the new Unsolved Mysteries on Netflix.
Yeah, this is not a lot of hoopla around this one. There was a lot of buzz around the first season. I don't know if the reviews were in love with that first season. I know I certainly didn't hate it, but I certainly found it a little bit forgettable. Season two, just so everybody's listening, is, in my opinion, also very forgettable. So, all in all, I'm not trying to like put down the remarkable amount of work and cinematography and all of that that goes into producing this. It's just not really for me. There are other true crime documentaries that personally I feel do just a better job.
Totally agree. I was looking for every excuse to get out of watching these.
You posted a poll saying, hey, should we do that? Hoping that people are like, no. And we got an overwhelming response that we should in fact do it. So
I guess we're watching them all. So
I don't want to sound like a hater. I just, reading this, you know about so many things that happen around the country that nobody talks about. That is more interesting than all of these stories.
Yeah, totally. But let's jump in because my whole thing is these don't need to all be an hour long.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're like 45 minutes, 38 minutes. They kind of vary. But we're going to pretty much summarize them all in this episode. And obviously, spoilers ahead.
Yeah. Like, for instance, if you don't feel like sitting there for nearly 6 hours, you could just listen to this episode and learn everything that you need to know. Now, I know I threw at you and you probably roll your eyes when I say it, but we're going to do this in an old school stack style. So it's really one of these things where we're going to try our best to summarize each story in the way that the original Unsolved Mysteries did throughout the 80s and 90s.
Which I personally think is a better format. And I'm not trying to be a hater, but I'm being honest. This is totally how I feel. So the first story is Washington Insider Murder. In Wilmington, Delaware, the last day of 2010, the body of an older white male is found in a landfill. And we actually kind of see it. They censor it out, which we do not get the luxury of in other episodes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
But yeah, we see him like kind of laying there in this trash heap. And so he's wearing a West Point Academy ring from 1966. And this man is ID'd as John Jack Wheeler, who was like an aide in the Bush administration.
He was a bigwig. He was somebody who was overseeing the attack of our digital system. You always hear like our digital grid is going to be under attack. And it very often is. We've talked about EMF attacks in the past. So his job was basically to protect us from that. Now, we're talking about a major, major, major position in the government and a very controversial position in the middle of a Democrat-led administration. So I'm just putting it out there so you understand that he's a Republican and he works within a Democrat administration.
You mean like
in a very tense time? He
right,
was an aide
Obama?
For Bush. No. When he was still working, he was still working for the government in 2010.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And he is a Vietnam veteran. We learn like what a good guy he is. And he actually was instrumental in the construction of the Vietnam War Memorial.
Yes.
So he took it very seriously. They said he was always working, go. And we do learn that he was also bipolar. We meet his adorable little wife, who I love, Catherine Kleiss. And, you know, it's kind of speculated that this may be a governmental hit because he is like the cybersecurity guy.
Yeah. I think it's more simple, personally. Me too. I think, although it is a complete theory that's out there, that this is something that is all done by some type of the owners of the government, whoever that might be. But I personally think that once they said the bipolar thing, my mind went, having friends who have had bipolar or are bipolar, I've seen these kind of breaks, I've experienced them. And this to me, because we do get to see some very, very eye-opening footage of an older man, kind of lost. He, almost showing signs of dementia, but not really.
That's kind of how I felt, yeah.
But when I've always likened bipolar, and I could be totally wrong, that it's kind of forgetting, it's not forgetting who you are, but it's kind of forgetting your, you have no more filter. It's like you're not understanding, you're scared, you're paranoid, and you need to get somewhere, and you're not sure where that is. So we see footage of him kind of, we see all types of surveillance footage. They actually go and they start tracking his movements, which is kind of interesting. But he does call the police to let him know. He doesn't call the police, sorry. He calls the company that he works for called MITRE.
Yeah, they do military contracting.
Right. It's a government-run and paid-for organization, but it is – I'm forgetting what they're called. But they're funded by the government, but they're private. That's basically where these kind of guys end up working. But he lost some sensitive information that belonged to them. He also, in that briefcase, I think.
Okay. But we have to go back one because.
Sorry.
So, no, it's okay. So when his body's discovered, coincidentally, at that same time, cops are actually responding to a burglary at his house. His neighbor was kind of in charge of watching this house because he split his time many different places. So his neighbor would watch over the place. One day he notices the door is ajar. There's like spices thrown all over the place. There's Comet, like the sink cleaner Comet, all over the floor. There's footprints in the floor and his like trusty briefcase is missing.
Like he kind of had some type of, he might have had a fit and threw crap everywhere.
Yeah. And if we're going with the burglary theory, it's unusual for the burglars to go through like your spice cabinet. You know, like that's just not their go-to thing. So he also loses his cell phone on the December 28th. He leaves his wife in New York City. They spent Christmas together. They had a great time. So he goes for a few hours to Washington, D.C. He goes back home to his house in D.E., Delaware. And I was trying to be cool. But that night, his neighbor is building a new house and it's very contentious. He doesn't think the neighbor should build the new house because it's blocking his views. So all these smoke bombs start going off in the house. And when police arrive, they find his cell phone outside of there. So on December 29th is when he emails MITRE and tells them that his house was burglarized and that he lost sensitive info. And at 6 p.m., he shows up at a pharmacy. And this is where we start getting the surveillance footage.
But he tells MITRE that his house is burglarized, possibly. Yeah. But he doesn't tell the police.
Right.
Which is kind of strange. I'm also kind of, you work for the government in this kind of tight type of thing. You don't have surveillance cameras in 2010. To me, there's a lot strange stuff going on here.
That's a good point. Yeah. And, you know, speaking of strange, when he goes to the pharmacy, he's not even like getting his medicine. He's just begging people for a ride to take him to Wilmington.
I don't know about that. Is it possible he was trying to fill a script for something? Because he does go to the pharmacy part of this drugstore.
Yeah, he does.
It's not like he goes to the register to buy gum. He goes to the actual pharmacy.
That's a good point. And we assume he's on some kind of medication because, like we said, he is bipolar. And let's be honest, he's an older guy. He's probably on something.
I was saying this to me sounds like maybe he's going through a break. He's paranoid. He's trying to hide. He's trying to do something. By the way, that surveillance footage in that drugstore is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From 10 years ago.
10 years ago.
Yeah. We see like local footage around here and it's like, well, this is, that place was just built. Like, why are the cameras so bad? So,
yeah. Anyway. Well, what we do know from the pharmacy is that he leaves with a man who takes him to Wilmington. And it's like he's looking for his car. He's getting like frustrated,
he's
agitated.
Limping, by the way, he this has, whole time, including in the pharmacy, he's limping.
He's limping a little bit. And when we get to the parking garage footage where he's trying to find his car, he actually has his shoe in his hand. One shoe. He's wearing the other one. So he tells people like his briefcase is stolen, and we are to take away that he looks like he's being stalked, but I didn't get that at all. I thought it was a frustrated old man trying to find his car. And by the way, his car was like blocks away. He wasn't even near. He wasn't even in the right parking garage.
This happened to me in Vegas, and it's like these car garages all look the same, especially when you've been in a casino for a long time and you push the stupid button and you hear it and it sounds like it's from a mile away or on another floor. And it's extremely disturbing to do that. And that's kind of what they're doing in this entire scene. It's a kick, kick. And you, it's to me, if you're going through some type of psychological issue and on top of that, you can't find a place to sit down, you know, like your safe car and lock yourself in and just cry yourself to sleep or something. It really just makes everything 10 times worse. And I think that's like, what he was going through. That's all.
If you're going through an episode, hypothetically speaking, there is no worse place than a parking garage. Okay. It's dark. The ceilings are low. Mm-hmm. You hear the beep, beep. You hear cars screeching. You hear footsteps behind you, even though they're not behind you. Like, it is a creepy place to be. And it's like sensory overload.
Yes.
So we learn on December 30th, the day before he's discovered in the landfill, that he was in this building called the Nemours Building. And it appears that he spent the night and most of the day in the basement. At some point, he asked people to take him to Philadelphia. And 2 hours later at 8:30, he's seen exiting the building wearing a dark colored hoodie. But the rest of his outfit is like a suit, like a business suit. But he's wearing this hoodie that he got from somewhere.
Definitely weird, because it's not the kind of thing. I think they were even stating it's not something he would normally wear.
Yeah, and like his wife says, his adorable little wife says, like, we saw his body, but we could only see him to identify him from his face up because he was so badly bruised and battered. So we have this guy who's like an article newspaper writer who is like dead set on proving that this was a hit. He was beat up for government secrets and everything. But is it possible? Okay, well, I'm sorry. We find that he may have been sleeping in a dumpster. And that's how he got to the dump.
The investigation gets a little bit crazy in this point. They start swabbing dumpsters for DNA.
Yeah.
That's wild to me. Like, it's like, wow, this is I can't imagine how much money is being spent on this just to find out, like, nothing, really. I mean, but I think that you and I do agree that's possible, because we think that, or they think that the theory is that he crawled into the dumpster for some level of warmth, or just protection. You know, it's the middle of winter.
Yeah.
And he fell asleep in there, maybe. And when the garbage man came, maybe he was already dead. Maybe he got thrashed around and
they smushed those trash machines down. If he was asleep, say, because the guy said, like, you can't always hear people when they're in the dumpsters, if he got put into the back of the trash truck, he would have gotten smushed there, let alone when the machinery is pushing the equipment, you know, the trash around at the dump
site. And you can't hear anybody, like, hey, you know, like, you're not going to hear it. And it's a terrible way to die. I don't know if you can determine if you're being crushed to death, really, or I don't know. If you're surrounded by a bunch of garbage, wouldn't it look like you got beat up by it? If you're gonna,
I mean,
crush
to I'm death? Just saying, I think that the any broken bones, any bruising, any battering could have easily happened from the landfill on, or from getting tossed into a machine. I mean, they toss when they pick dumpsters up on the forklift and they put it, that's like an 8-foot drop into the thing.
Yeah.
And then
it crushes you.
So that's what I
think.
So
you could just, all you have to do is bang your head on something. I mean, it's made of like steel or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm going with the fact that he personally, I think he had a bipolar episode, very unfortunate. And this was what happened. This was the outcome. He went in there and he got killed. I don't think
I personally don't see the mystery there. But this next one is a mystery. But again, it probably should have been like a 5 or 10 minute segment.
Yeah, this is more of a, in my opinion, this was more of an obsession from trying to find something within nothing.
Yeah.
That's all. I think that it makes for a good story, but it takes us all the way to Oslo, Norway.
In 1995.
In the middle of the 90s, we get a woman checks into a fancy hotel. I believe it's a Radisson Blu now. And it just looks like a really beautiful modern hotel. And somehow checks in without giving a credit card. Now, I don't know if that was something that was possible back then. I mean, is it possible that she just paid cash up front? I'm not sure. But
I mean, yeah, but it took 4 days for them to realize that she hadn't given a credit card.
I mean, it's possible she paid ahead of time and then she's like, all right, well, what about tonight? You know, that type of
yeah.
thing.
And I know that the 90s were different, but I've never been able to do that at a hotel because they need to hold it in case there's damages in the hotel.
Yeah. No, and it makes sense, but I just don't know how it is in Oslo. That's all.
True.
You know, Oslo isn't some like booming city. I mean, it's big for Norway, but it's Norway. So the security guard goes up there to basically, you know, say you have to pay and just kind of knocks and then hears a gunshot.
So he goes to security headquarters to report this gunshot and leaves the room completely alone for 15 minutes until his superior can come back up.
I would do the same thing because he's not a police officer. He's a security guard.
Right, but I'm just saying maybe he could walkie-talkie that down to them.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
We have no idea
yeah.
if like anybody came in or out of that room after during those 15 minutes. So he knocks. There's no answer. The door is locked from the inside. The security guard's able to gain access, and he finds a woman laying on the bed with a gunshot wound to the head. So they call the police, and the woman is dead with a gun in her hand. Now, at this point, they show some serious pictures of her dead body, like bleeding, like, ugh, it startled
me. Yeah, and there's
me.
Blood all over the sheets. And it's very,
yeah.
I don't think it was necessarily needed to.
Yeah.
But we see a lot of close-ups post-mortem, and we see a lot of very creepy sketches that people spent a little too much time on. And spent a lot of alone time with. And it just, they seem to have gotten obsessed with this woman. And they need to figure out, well, I guess I'm jumping even a little ahead. They figure out, you know, they need to identify this person, of course.
Yeah.
They do determine it looks as though it's a suicide. She appears to have shot herself in the head.
Right. But they don't have anything on her. ID, a passport, car keys, home keys. She had a briefcase, so they open it up, and the only thing that's in there is just, like, loose bullets. All her clothing labels were torn out of her clothes, and she also had no clothes to wear from the waist down, they say, but it appeared that she was wearing tights or something.
Mm-hmm.
On her registration card for the hotel, she gives her name as Jennifer Fairgate, and she gave this address to this like rural little town in Belgium. So we like hop over to Belgium, and the town and street exist, but the address does not exist.
It's a lot of resources just to figure out what happened here. It just seems there's something here that I think that they were really seeking out, and there's no story that he keeps finding a dead end. He meets locals and shows the drawing of them, and people are like, no. It's a small village. Like, it's not like a big booming city like Oslo.
Right.
And, and it's nobody identifies her. But, you know,
no,
she also kind of looks like Joan Jett. So it's kind of like maybe she had long hair, maybe she dyed it. You know, they're. Have a brunette in Norway or Belgium, for that matter, is not exactly the most common thing in the world.
Interesting. I didn't think about it that way. Yeah, she did have like almost jet black hair.
Yeah, my friend who lives in Norway, who has black hair, you know, he stands out like a sore thumb.
I'll bet. Well, we learned that before staying at the hotel, she called and said she'd be staying with a guy named Lewis Fairgate, spelled Lois but pronounced Lewis. And that name was also on the registration card. And the front desk woman reports seeing a man standing next to her. Mm-hmm. So There's no record of the police looking through security cams. And a year after to the day, they kind of unceremoniously buried her. They didn't have a headstone because they didn't have any information about her.
No, I found that, and I don't know how true this is. I found it on Facebook, but all of her jewelry, and she had a diver's watch, and all these things were sold in a police auction. Her leather jacket. And it's just, I put a link to it somewhere in these notes, and it's, I don't know that, I mean, you're looking for a lot of information, but, you know, having a ring, a gold ring, I think that was on, one of her middle fingers, that, you know, that could have been traced, I guess, to some point.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would imagine it's not something you'd want to get rid of, but, you know, I mean, what can you do? So
yeah, police auctions exist. I mean, that's the whole thing.
Yeah, the weird thing is, because everyone's like, okay, shut, open, shut, suicide. But we learned that she was holding the gun backwards, which means that she had her thumb on the trigger and her, like, other four fingers on the back of the handle of the gun. And there are no blood spots on her hand, and they theorize that maybe she was murdered. Now, we also learned, my personal favorite is that maybe she is an assassin. And the reason we think that is because this hotel is like the top meeting place for officials. And there was even at the time a secret meeting going on between Israeli and Palestinian officials. That we learned that the gun registration numbers were completely erased.
Yeah.
And supposedly cutting tags out of your clothing is a spy thing to do.
I don't know. I was doing this during my 90s era thing where it's like, no brands. It's not a no Gap sweater. It's a no branded sweater, you know. And for real, though. I mean, that was like a real thing. You know, it was like a no brand type of movement of like, you know, the post grunge type of thing.
I believe it, but I was also picturing you like shopping at Banana Republic and like, cutting those out.
Not even kidding. I would go to Benetton and get a sweater and be like, snip, snip. Nice sweater, right? Vintage. It's like, doesn't smell vintage, smells pretty new. So I don't know. I think that this person who I have his name here somewhere, but he maybe I don't, but the person who's going on and on about her just seems to be romanticizing this person, and he seems to be obsessed with her in a weird, very weird kind of way. Did you get that at all or no?
I mean, his life was definitely run by her. He's like a newspaper guy. He's I'm assuming the guy who called Unsolved Mysteries. He is the guy like moving this forward. So they're able to like exhume her body. They get a DNA profile.
Can I just ask you a question? So they buried her and they have photographs of the funeral that no one is at. Who paid for this?
Oh, I know. It's so sad.
Is it sad?
The city of Norway.
No. They have a funeral, a viewing? Who's paying? They're going to pay for a viewing?
Yeah.
It's like $15,000.
I mean, it was.
I don't know. It's kind of like in, you know, in New York, if you die, you're a pauper. You know what I mean? You get a pine box.
Maybe yeah, that's but that's New York.
Florida, too.
Norway. Florida too. Oh, definitely. No, I'm not saying otherwise, but I'm just picturing Norway, where the land where
I need to
care.
Find out. I need to ask my friend Jerry because it just doesn't make sense that they would have a viewing like that. Just seems weird to me that they would do that.
It wasn't really a viewing. They did put her in with a bunch of chairs, and the chairs were all empty. But it was a year after. Nobody's viewing that a year after.
All right.
Okay. Somebody's paying for it, though. But we do learn that she has this certain amount of like radiation in her teeth, which is like from bombing during the Cold War and stuff. So we learn that she was likely born in 1971, making her about 24 years old at her time of death.
Yeah, I think that I think the sad fact is she maybe had no family and that's it. I mean, I just don't, I think it's a tragic end, of course. You know, if somebody's listening and you're sad and you're like, I want to just end my life. Don't just keep downloading our podcast. No, but I'm making a joke there, but I'm at the same time, just don't. Tomorrow will be fine. But, it's just, I just don't think that it's nice in a way. Like, this didn't make me walk away thinking like you're doing anything positive for this person.
What didn't?
This whole investigation, it just seems like this person was clearly struggling with something, and we're just turning it into entertainment at this point. There's nothing there to indicate any of this, really.
It was definitely an odd choice, but oh my God, speaking of odd choices, this next episode, I couldn't believe what I was watching. It was crazy.
Yeah, this one was, I think, the most eye-opening and scary one. The Death Row Fugitive.
Crazy. Yeah.
Goes back to the mid-60s in Mansfield, Ohio. We get, this is a pretty good reenactment too. The acting is pretty good in this particular episode. But Lester Banks murdered and attempted to rape a 14-year-old.
Eubanks.
Oh, did I say Eubanks?
You said Banks.
Oh, sorry. Lester Eubanks murdered and attempted to rape a 14-year-old girl named Mary Ellen Diener. Mm-hmm. And what we learn later is really even more tragic about that. So her and her sister went to go do the laundry, you know, which is, mm-hmm. I'm going to say, not the most uncommon thing to do in this area. It seemed like they had family right next to the laundromat. It was something that they probably have done in the past.
It was like 6 p.m. too. It was not even that late or anything. Mm-hmm. And 14 and 12, yeah, you can handle, you know, you can be by yourselves.
You're at that weird cusp. Like 14, you know, a 14, you watch over the 12-year-old. But they ran out of money, so they ran out of change. They had money, but they didn't have, like, you know, the change coin thing. I don't know if you've ever used a laundromat.
Yeah. Oh,
you're
yeah.
You're a very fancy lady.
Well, I don't know about that, but yeah. So Mary Ellen was like, you stay here to the 12-year-old. You stay here. I'll go to the other laundromat and get change. But she never came back.
Right.
So the grandma lives nearby. She's like, hey, what's going on? Where's Mary Ellen? And she's like, I don't know. Mary Ellen hasn't come back. So the grandma sees police, and all of a sudden she sees Mary Ellen laying on the ground shot. And again, we get a picture of this poor girl's dead body.
Yeah. I really, like, I know a lot of people go, well, you just can't handle it. It's like, I don't know. It's a kid, you know?
Yeah. And I don't want to handle seeing a dead 14-year-old that was like that this guy tried to rape. Like, it's horrible. I don't I'm sitting there eating my burrito trying to binge watch this so we can put together an episode, and I just was not expecting the amount of dead bodies that I saw.
But what kind of burrito? No.
Oh, black bean.
Nice.
But at the time of the murder, we find out that Lester Eubanks is out on attempted rape charges. They arrest him because the gun belongs to him. And he confesses. So his story is that he attempted to rape her and she screamed. So he shot her twice. And then what do you do after you shoot a 14-year-old twice? You get ready to go dancing. So he goes up to his apartment. He shaves, he showers, whatever. 45 minutes later, he passes back by the scene of the crime. And Mary Ellen is still alive. And she's like, help me, help me.
This stuck with me. Because it was like,
yes.
Oh my, this poor girl. Not only did she just go through this, and I don't know if he ended up doing any type of sexual abuse before her death.
Doesn't sound like it.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it, but you know what? I wouldn't put it past this guy.
Yeah.
But 45 minutes of agony and just hoping and praying somebody's going to walk by. And who walks by? The guy who shot you.
Exactly. So what does he do? He picks up a brick and he bashes her head and killing her. So he is sentenced to death row, and his execution just happens to get stayed three different times. We know all these like little technicalities pop up. So in 1972, the death penalty gets completely abolished in the state of Ohio, and he's moved to general population.
I guess there's no grandfathering in, right?
That's what I was thinking. Yeah, but here's where it gets super crazy. In December of 1973, he gets a furlough to go Christmas shopping.
This was insanity.
At the local mall.
Insanity to me.
Yeah, wearing civilian attire without a guard with him.
Now, the reason why he got this this access to the public is because he had such good behavior, and he became kind of part of this little outreach program, right, where hey, right. We'll take these guys who are pretty great. He's also a very accomplished artist inside and probably a very likable person. There's photographs of him with his arm around these women who I'm not really sure who the women are. And it's like, do you know he's a rapist? You know, like, do you know he killed a child?
Yeah. And by the way, this furlough that he goes out on, A, I don't understand why a prisoner would even need to buy Christmas presents. But B, this is only 8 years after he killed her. So it, when it comes time for everybody to meet up, because keep in mind, they're just unleashing like a busload of prisoners dressed like civilians at this mall where
it's
everybody's
like a comedy.
Doing their Christmas
it's
shopping.
Like, it's literally a feel. I mean, I'm not making light of it. It feels like this is a setup for a comedy.
Yeah. And guess what? He's gone. He left. He hightailed it. So they put out a warrant for him. We find out 20 years later that the warrant was not in the system due to a quote-unquote clerical error. So he actually had run-ins with the police, and he was just let go because there was no warrant in the system for him, even though he was an escaped death row inmate.
Now, can you imagine? He probably went and got fake ID. I'm just going to say, because it's not like you would keep your ID, right? I mean, you know you're on the run, but he could have. He could have just lived his normal stuff, probably done his taxes, everything.
Yeah, and, you know, we get an age progress photo of him, and we learn that there is a $25,000 reward, and that's where we are now. Although I did see this morning on TMZ that, like, a ton of tips are coming in for this particular case.
I mean, it's good. He escaped 47 years ago. I mean, it's...
I know. He's lived most of his life out. It's crazy. But you know what? I mean, if we can make the last few years of his life in prison, then good.
Now, this next episode, I just want to have a tip for anybody. This is one of the, I think we can both agree, it's the most beautiful of all the episodes, cinematography.
It's my favorite. It's my favorite of the six, definitely.
But if you just want to know what's going on here, you could skip to 15 minutes in.
Yeah,
you can read Wikipedia about the tsunami in 2011, and you could just skip 15 minutes in.
Yeah, tragic, tragic tsunami. We get a lot of very real footage of it. 20,000 lives were lost. There was an earthquake and then a tsunami. We hear a lot of sob stories about, like, people being, like, finding their relatives, like, blocks away.
You remember
dead.
This, right, when this happened?
Oh, yeah.
This was tremendous. This is an extremely tragic situation. You know, it's... One of these things also, it's around the time where I started reading about the Richter and the Mercalli scale. The Mercalli scale tends to be a higher number because when there's a 9.0, it's not really a 9.0 anymore. It's just, it's weird, but this was a legitimate, crazy earthquake. I think, to be honest with you, it might have even been higher on the Richter. So it might have been 11.0 on the Richter.
And we see, like, before and after footage, and there's, like, a whole... city just gone, like wiped away, gone. It's crazy.
Yeah, so, it's just one of those things you look at and you're like, these poor people, I don't care who they are, I don't care how I feel about their politics, these poor people.
And we hear a lot of ghost stories because the thing is, all these people are lost and they want to come home and they're confused because this big sudden event happened. It's not like they had like a sickness and they were coming to terms with coming to death. They were just there one day and like washed out to see the next. So we hear about this man who went to go see if his mom was safe, and he found her in this shelter. And he's like, "Mom, oh my God, let me take a picture of you to send to our family."
Yeah.
So he takes a picture of her, and then he realizes that her face changed completely and it wasn't his mom.
But we never get to see the photo.
I wish we would have gotten to see that photo.
I mean, it's a good story. You know, it's a very good story. It's a story I've heard before. That's all. All of these stories. I've heard all of these stories told in different ways. And even in Japanese culture, there's all these stories of these type of things. Now, I'm not saying they're not true. I'm just simply saying I've heard these before.
And we hear a lot. So one of the stories is like this woman who lost her 3-year-old son. And then one night his toys started going off out of the blue. And we hear another one that's like a clear night. And this woman hears a knock at her door and she answers the door. And there's a woman who is like dripping wet. And she is like, "Please, please, can I have some dry
clothes?"
That
was the scariest one to me. I don't know why.
Yeah.
And why are you answering the door?
I don't know.
It's a tsunami that just happened. Don't answer the door.
No, this was like years after.
I know.
This was like years.
I'm affected.
I feel like I was there watching all the footage. It was crazy.
Yeah,
so,
it was, like some of that footage, I mean, it is horrifying. It really is.
Yeah, and we get to meet this little like cute little ghost whisperer lady who said she's always been sensitive to other spirits, you know, other worlds. And so she tells about how ghosts want to go home, but because they can't go home because home is no longer there because their home with their loved ones and everything was also swept away. Like they don't know their way around the city. So we hear several stories about taxi drivers who would let people in and they would drive all the way home and then the person would just vanish in their back seat.
I was pointing out how, like, in 2011, you know, cabs are already outfitted in New York City with cameras. So, I mean, I hate to, like, be like the Debbie Downer here. I'm not believing any of these stories, but I do think that it's a good way to deal with it. I think that it's not, I think they're nice. I think that it brings us to the next point of healing.
And you better not have anything bad to say about my little reverend, because I love him so much.
I got notes, Kim. Against his entire belief system to believe on any of this.
I know, but he was so cool. So
He was the coolest guy out of all of it, and I really do personally love the guy.
I think he's a genuinely good person. But we meet Ami, I'm going to say. I don't remember how it's pronounced, sorry. But
hi, Ami.
She says she's possessed. And she comes to our cute little Buddhist reverend guy for help. And he performed what I would call like a Buddhist exorcism.
I think they called it. Did they call it that? They might have said exorcising.
I think they might have, yeah. And so she's basically saying that they're... are spirits coming through her that are like, help, I need to get out, I need to go home. So he would help them. He and his adorable little wife would help the spirits like come out of her body. Mm-hmm. But the more he exercised, the more spirits would come into her body. And we hear this heart-wrenching story about this little girl who comes through Ami. And she's like, I let go of my brother's hand. I was supposed to hold my brother's hand and I had to let go. And he got swept into the ocean. And eventually the little girl did too. But she was like, I can't go to the light until I tell my mom that I'm sorry.
Well, Kim, I just want to make an announcement, though, that our next episode out of the country might be live at the Cafe des Monks.
Loved it. Yeah. So the sweet little reverend wife is like, I am your mother. Hold my hand. It's okay. I forgive you. And this little girl is finally able to go towards the light. So this reverend says that he makes this thing called the Café du Monk, where people can actually talk about their grief and kind of heal together, because apparently that is not like very Japanese to do, to like talk about suffering and stuff. So he has this place where his wife will like bake cakes and he plays the guitar and everybody can just kind of talk about the sorrow that they have, the PTSD that this whole country has.
He's like the indie Buddhist guy. He's somehow more Buddhist than the Buddhists.
Yeah, and he even said, like this is going against my religion, but I don't think any god would punish me for it. I think they would say, good job, you're helping people.
Now, I thought that I thought cinematography was beautiful. There was way too much drone footage in every single aspect of this reboot, season one and season two. No more drone footage, please. But that being said, I really enjoyed seeing this. It reminded me how badly I want to go to Japan. And,
yes.
And I know my son wants to go, so we're really going to try to keep pushing that. But that being said, I think what they're doing is really wonderful. This has gotten really panned because people who watch this show, this is a subtitled episode. This is in Japanese mostly. And people don't seem to know how to read, maybe. And so it's gotten panned, really. It's, I don't want to read. It's like, oh, God, it's not a book.
It's really a beautiful episode. I think it's a worthwhile watch. I thought it was the most entertaining of all of them. But if you are wanting some English, we are going to hop over to Grosse Pointe, Michigan.
Now, let me just say about Grosse Pointe, Michigan story. This one reminded me the most out of season one and season two of this Netflix reboot of the closest legitimate unsolved mysteries type of episode. This is appropriate. This was too long. All of these episodes are way too long. All of them should be 15 minutes.
Yeah.
But at the same time, this one, if they summed it up in 15 minutes, I would have loved this story. But there's a lot of fluff in the middle, and it was still one of the better received episodes to me.
Yeah, so we have a car belonging to 55-year-old Joanne Romaine, and it is found abandoned next to St. Paul's Catholic Church. And this church is across the street from this gorgeous lake. You know, it's Michigan, so there's going to be a billion lakes up there. But this lake feeds into the Detroit River. Her purse is in the car still. And the detectives, when they arrive, because this car is abandoned, they see footprints leading to the lake. So they do a search and rescue mission in like the middle of the night. It's 12 degrees out and these guys are all in the water. And we find out that Joanne had a 7 p.m. prayer service at the church. And by 9:20, Joanne's kids are informed by a police officer that their mom is missing. And her kids are all in their 20s. So now, these are like grown up kids.
I have to just ask you, where else have you ever heard of a search and rescue mission going on within hours?
Honestly, never.
Never, right? I mean,
yeah.
How do they know it's abandoned? I mean, there could be a car parked on the side of my house for a month and I wouldn't even notice it.
Yeah. No, it was very, very quick moving.
Like, and somebody knew something. This, yeah. Exactly. It was very quick moving. And there had to have been some piece of evidence to determine that, for real, she's missing and something bad happened.
And as we learn from the Unsolved Mysteries with Robert Stack episodes that we do, they don't tell us everything, Unsolved Mysteries. No. They got to keep some cards close to the chest so they can verify information that comes in. So I don't know if there was blood or anything. I'm just speculating at this point. But we do learn that the parents of these kids who are all in their 20s are separated and it is contentious. So police think that Joanne, in 4-inch heels, walked from the car to the water and committed suicide.
It's snowy out. It's icy. It's the middle of January in Michigan.
She had to cross 4 lanes of traffic. The lake was partially frozen. It was only 1 to 2 feet deep. And there's little to no current. So we also learned that the bottom, by the way, is like bouldery, rocky, very difficult terrain to navigate.
It wouldn't be the place that you would go to try to drown yourself.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so. So we do learn that she worked at this like fancy boutique in the suburbs outside of Detroit. And we get this private investigator that just like sends a woman out in high heels to walk down there. And it's like, oh, see, it's hard to do.
Yeah. And there's no snow on the ground. It's just like, all right. I mean, it was a weird reenactment.
He said, I wanted to test it. So I was expecting seeing him in the 4-inch heels going down.
When he was putting it on, they only showed the shoe and he's putting, like, I just see the foot. And I'm like, is that him? Is he seriously going to wear these heels?
No, he just had some poor, probably woman he was dating or something do that. So we do know at 6:25 p.m., Joanne got gas at a gas station. And it's thought, keyword thought, that at 7:05, she was at the prayer service. There was a witness who says that they saw Joanne, even though they were in the front of the church and Joanne sat all the way in the back of the church. And it was dark in there. So at 7:15, only 10 minutes after it's thought that she went to the prayer service, she left. And the kids hire that crazy private investigator we were talking about, and they get her cell records. And apparently she had been calling a security company because she was starting to get kind of nervous and paranoid before her disappearance.
Yeah. There definitely seems to me that there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes here. We do get introduced to two brothers, very shady brothers, right? They're both kind of questionable. One is a police officer. The other one is the bad guy. And
I think that the police officer is a cousin.
Oh, really? I'm sorry. Yeah, Jim. No, no. There's Jim and John.
Yeah, yeah.
The daughters, of course, are all very upset and they do have to bring up over and over again, I just need to point this out, how, I guess, affluent the area is. And they need to point out that it's her Lexus. And just, I don't know, there's something about this that just to me, like, all right, I get it. You know, like, you're happy with where you live and you're proud of it, I guess. But this isn't really the place to really talk about that, I think.
Yeah.
It was just a weird point, that's all.
But while you're talking about the Lexus, can I just say at like 7:20, witnesses say that her car alarm went off for like 15 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And at 7:35, the last witness to leave the prayer service says that the driveway was completely empty and that the car was not there. But keep in mind, it is dark. It is like late at night. I think that it's possible that this person just didn't see the car. But we do know when the car is next seen, it's parked slightly differently than when she left it. So maybe the car did leave.
Yeah, I mean, we know that because I guess maybe it was raining or snowing and the imprint around it. I'm not really sure how we know that it's different than before when we think maybe it didn't move.
And this is not something as a witness that you're going to be paying attention to unless you're thinking a crime is going to happen. I don't pay attention to how the cars are parked when I pull up.
Yeah, again, there's anywhere. No surveillance footage. There's nothing.
Yeah. So on March 20th of 2010, her body is found 35 miles away on Boblo Island in Canada. And, you know, it's Michigan. It's the top of the United States. It really was just barely over the Canadian border, but it was on this little island. Just you could tell it got washed downstream.
But downstream. Okay, this is 2 feet of water. It's not, you know, you can't even get a boat.
Yeah.
Like you couldn't even get a little tiny rickety boat in there.
Yeah, and, you know, we learn a lot of things that said that she probably didn't commit suicide. She filled up her gas tank. Who does that? Mm-hmm. She had just bought this, like, brand new purse, and it's ripped. And apparently she carried the purse always on her left shoulder, and when they found her body, she had a couple bruises on her left arm. So they think maybe somebody was, like, trying to take it away from her and pulling on it. So we don't know. The purse is never tested. Her car keys were found in an inner pocket of her coat on her body, but we never find her rosary or her cell phone.
Couldn't it have been keyless entry at that point? I'm pretty sure they had keyless entry in most Lexuses in 2010.
Oh, see, you are too fancy for me, sir. I have no idea.
No, you're the fancy one.
Oh, have you heard of a laundromat, Kim? That's where people do laundry with quarters. But
to where people like me go when our dryers break.
The family's theory, though, is that she was, like, abducted from the church parking lot, pushed into her own car, driven down the Detroit River several miles, and then the bad guys push her in the river and drive the car back to the church.
But there's no DNA evidence of any of this. I mean, then again, her DNA is all over the car. It's her car. But there's no other fingerprints.
Yeah, and the keys were in her pocket on her. So.
Also, they didn't talk about the amount of gas in the car. Would that, if you filled it up, wouldn't there be a decent amount of gas missing?
I never thought about that. That's brilliant.
But they never tested it, probably. They probably drove home their Lexus, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
My car now.
And we, you know, we do learn about the shady gentleman in her life. You know, we have a son. I mean, son, brother John and cousin Jim. Jim is the cop who Mark was talking about earlier. And, like, the grandma matriarch of this family died. And they all got into a very contentious fight over the inheritance. So the daughter says that Joanne had an argument with Tim, her cousin, over the phone a few weeks before she went missing. And it ended with something like, don't ever call me or my family ever again. Now, one of my biggest pet peeves... because I just frankly don't believe it, is that the daughter says before Joanne died, Joanne said, quote, if anything ever happens to me, look to Tim.
You know what? I 100% believe her because she's a white girl. No, I do not believe her at all. And I have to say that if you're going to tell me this, Kim, I'm going to press record. Because we've heard this time and time again in so many different places. Take 5 seconds to record it, then, if it's so important.
I honestly feel like probably 33% of the true crime I watch says, you know, if something ever happens to me, this person did it. And by the way, you guys, if something ever happens to me, Mark did it.
It's recorded.
I'm just kidding. I'm just you kidding. Sorry. No, I'm just kidding. Please don't arrest Mark. I got you again. But we do learn that we have this like whole police deposition going on throughout where the cops are like, it's a suicide. It's a suicide. And it does look a little homicide-y, but we learn that the family sues the city for conspiracy to cover up Joanne's murder, and they lose.
Yeah, they I don't know. They have to have spent a bundle on this private investigator.
Yeah.
How much does it, I wonder if anybody's listening, how much does it cost to have?
You know what? I have an answer for that, actually, because I'm doing research for a future case. And they hired this person in 1981. They hired this person for $20 an hour, plus 25 cents a gallon for gas.
So you're looking at maybe a grand a week of, like, you know, 40 hours a week.
Yeah, and that's an 81 money, so I would triple that.
Yeah, it's not bad. I mean, I think it's a hell of a lot of money. I mean, I would do that. But I mean, $3,000, you know, if you were to spend $12,000 to, you know, crack the case, you know.
Yeah.
Did you know it would take 2 months, though, so $24,000.
Yeah, true. And I mean, you know, they had that Lexus money, so I'm sure that they had the money to hire somebody private. But
newsflash, I bet it was a lease. That's all I'm saying.
I bet you're not wrong. But this next one went by in a flash. Oh, my God. This was a quickie.
Can I just also say about this episode? I mean, this particular episode is maybe to the people who are listening or writing season 3 of Unsolved Mysteries, maybe don't put in 2 episodes about missing kids. I don't know. Maybe do a UFO one. Maybe cover a real ghost story. Maybe do something that's, I don't know, a little bit more thematic and something that's more in the vein of the original Unsolved Mysteries than doing the stories that they've chosen, which this entire season did not resonate with me.
No, me neither. This reboot, I'm just begging them to speed it up a little bit. Yeah, though, this whole series to me, I'm like, I was literally sitting there like, I could have watched 6 Robert Stack Unsolved Mysteries in the time it's taken me to watch.
You and I are recording another episode of this in 2 days. And I finished watching these and I said, oh my God, I love the original Unsolved Mysteries. Like, it was like a breath of fresh air. This felt like I was really putting effort into watching it. And the other one was kind of like, I'm just chilling out, watching, is eating a little bit of popcorn. So
totally.
I had nothing but enjoyment for our upcoming episode in 2 days. It's just this, I don't know. Maybe I'm not a modern true crime kind of guy, but this is just slow.
It was so slow. And this one's called Stolen Kids. It's in Harlem, New York. We're in 1989. 2-year-old Christopher goes missing while playing in the park one day. It's from the Martin Luther King Jr. Towers playground on Lenox Avenue. His mom, they say, was a drug addict at the time, and she kind of left him in the park while she went to, like, quote, get snacks for him.
Now she cleaned up her act a lot. She ended up seeming to me to be very, very nice, like, sweet, and I really feel as though she does take some level of responsibility here, and I couldn't imagine having that kind of guilt, of course, but it's just one of those things. You can't turn your back on your little kid, especially when you're in a bad area.
I agree, but there's 5 or so adults watching the kids at the park, including his own aunt. So it's not like she was just like, here you go, 2-year-old, go by yourself. Like, there were some adults.
I'm shaking my head the whole time you're talking, because that to me is not good enough. It's just, I don't accept it.
It's not sufficient, but it was something, you know? Yeah. So I don't know. You know, I was like a free range child, so maybe I view this a little differently. But
I was too, and I was the kid who would get lost from time to time. It's just, I don't know. I just, maybe I'm too much of a helicopter parent, and I just, putting myself in that situation, I wouldn't be able to ever forgive myself.
If I agree that you would not be able to forgive yourself, but would you not feel comfortable leaving your sister to watch your son, you know, like, while he's at the park, you know that she's there?
A 2-year-old? No. I mean, it's, no. I mean, I just, personally, no.
Well, head on over to Unsolved Mysteries Rewind Podcast. We'll make a poll and you can vote on who is right, your B or Mark. But 3 months later, in August of 1989, little baby Shane, 19-month-old, also goes missing from the same park. Now, Shane's mom, who I love, said that 2 little kids that were a boy and a girl, like ages 8 to 10, were like, can we play with the baby? Can we play with the baby? And she was like, get out of here, kids. And like,
I'm busy talking to this guy, can't you see?
Yeah, and this man comes up and they said, like, distracted her by talking to her. Uh-huh. And then all of a sudden she can't find the two kids or the baby. So she's searching all around and they show, like, the panic and the swirling and the kids playing and you're looking for your kid. Like, that panicky, anxious.
Yeah, it was like a Hitchcock film all of a sudden. Again, not to belittle any of this.
No.
I don't wish this upon anyone. I wish this person had some resolution.
Yeah, and she finds the 8-year-old and the 10-year-old, and she's like, where's my baby? And they're like, oh, we don't know. We were done playing with them, so we just left him.
Which makes me think it's more than just 2 or 3 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Ugh, it seems like these kids were kind of involved in a way. I don't know.
These are also – these playgrounds are usually kind of gated, too. So – but I don't know. I just – it's just one of those things you just can't turn your back on the kid. That's all. Even now, I have a 12-year-old. I still keep an eye on him.
Well, something weird is that both these abductions happened on Thursday evenings. And we kind of speculate on Unsolved Mysteries, like, is this a black market baby ring for people who can't have their own kids?
Yeah.
Or is this, like, a pedo ring and these kids are being sex trafficked?
Yes to everything, yeah, right? I mean, yeah. It's a terrible, terrible area of New York. This high crime period of time. Now, when it was announced that the second abduction happened, there was a tremendous police presence.
Oh, helicopters out. They shut it down.
I never heard of anything like this. I mean, I'm only 20 miles from where this happened.
And they were, like, checking out all the apartments nearby. And as you can imagine, there's a ton of apartments.
Well, these are
nearby.
Projects. I don't know if you've ever seen, like, these kind of projects. I don't mean that. That's not my laundromat comment. But it's... You know, these are usually, you know, up to like 30 stories high.
Wow.
There's elevators, but they're like slow as hell. And very often it's low income families. And these are, you know, there's a lot of crime that happens. If you ever seen The Wire, that's kind of like these type of things.
I haven't. I've seen my fair share of SVU, though, so I can imagine.
But worse, you know, it's because 1989, it's really bad there. I mean, the footage they show is legitimate for Harlem at the time.
Yeah, and we get a lot of, like, news footage of the time and everything. And then we kind of end with two age-progressed photos of the boys, which what we think they look like based on their parents' photographs and how their siblings turned out, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Now, my problem is, at the end, they're playing the music. I'm not even looking. I'm typing up my notes, whatever. They're showing, like, 15 other random-ass missing kids. Like, they're not even from the same area.
Yeah. Who the hell are these kids?
And they spend 1 second on them. It just felt slam, like, just shoved together. I don't know. It was tacky. It was, like, disrespectful almost that they're... They didn't even put the kid next to their age progressed photo. They would put two random kids up at one time, and then the next shot was both of their age progressed photos. I don't think it was the most effective way to get that information across. I didn't like that they just tacked it on to the end of another story. Like, I don't know. I didn't like it.
Yeah, it's like when you have a movie and you have, like, the like Prince song at the end, you know? It's kind of like just thrown in there. It's just filler.
So, yeah, and it was like, oh, well... Then we can say we showcased 12 missing kids this episode. It's like, can you, though? Because you really didn't do a good job.
I think season 2 should be the end of this particular series, personally. But I don't think that's going to happen.
Me too.
I think we're going to continue seeing more drone footage. And
now, here's my question to you, though. Do we cover season 3 if there is a season 3?
Well, I say yes. And this is why. Well, I say yes and no, because I can't predict the future. Now, if they want to come and say, and they want to contact us and say, well, you can't use our two words in your title of your show, then I say, you know what? You're dead to me. And I'll move on.
Oh.
And then I'll tell you what I really think. And but I say, as long as they stay on their side of the park, we continue covering it, honestly.
Okay. All right, then I will do it. I hope we did a good job. I'm not going to lie. I'm not super enthusiastic about this new season. I find it to be like homework. Like you said, like when you're watching Robert Stack, you're just like, oh, we're just chilling. But when you're doing this, it's like, oh, so slow.
You know what? On the Little House on the Prairie podcast that you're so often on with me, Walnut Grove cast, if they had come out with a Little House on the Prairie reboot of some sort, we'd have to cover it, even if it was likely very terrible. Right. It's part of the universe, and I just think that it deserves our honest opinions. Now, that's the other – that's the caveat. You get my honest opinion, which isn't always – I'm not always going to be in love with the work that like this. You got to speed it up.
Yeah.
I heard.
And you know what? Like, yeah. I'm not going to lie. I was so flattered when people said they wanted to hear us cover it. I was like, you guys, stop it.
It's like we really have some of the nicest listeners. And we really can't thank them enough for sticking with us. We just released our 30th episode today. I mean, this is probably 35 or 6 or 7 or something. But it's, you know, we're really, really putting out a lot of episodes. We're having a great time doing it. But hopefully they enjoy this, our take on it. You don't have to sit there and waste all your money on Netflix. You just download our episode.
Totally.
Free. All right. Well, Kim, thank you very much for spending 6 hours and watching this. And you know, well, that's another thing I do want to point out. These were shorter this time. Did you notice that? Yeah. So it's really more like 5 hours or 5 and a half.
Some were like half hour eps.
Season one had one that was well over an hour.
Really?
Yeah. And I was like, what are we doing here? It's like, watch a movie. So, but all in all, I really hope that they'll never hear us saying this, but you have the formula. You own the formula. You are Unsolved Mysteries. Do better. Yeah. Do 15-minute tellings of stories with a decent host. It's not like rocket science. It's what people want.
Right, and you're going to hit them in the nostalgia way harder if you go back to the original format.
Tonight, we have been confronted with an entire catalog of unexplained and unsolved events. Tune in next time as Unsolved Mysteries Rewind discusses another collection of unsolved mysteries. Until then, we can only look and wonder.